Continuous improvement comes in lots of different flavors and styles. I'm Bella Engelbach, and I'm inviting you to journey with me to the edges of lean. Episode 119, Continuously Improving Trust on Your Team with George Dahm. As lean leaders, we understand that trust is a key component of an effective and efficient team culture. Captain George Dahm spent years on high-performance environments where trust was not just a nice-to-have, it was necessary to make sure the entire team succeeded and survived. He joined me at the edges of lean to share his insights into developing trust in every environment by being a high-trust leader. George Dahm, welcome to the edges of lean.
Thank you, Bella. Very much, very happy to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you here today. Hey, George, I really want to hear about your career because it is such an interesting career. So tell us about yourself and what you've done in your life and a little bit about what you're doing today.
Okay, well, very quickly, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and my father had served in the Navy in World War II, and he encouraged me to take a look at that. And so I ended up going through the ROTC program in college and then embarking in a 26-year Navy career, flying fighters off of aircraft carriers. And in that time, I had some pretty extraordinary opportunities. For those that have seen the recent movie Top Gun Maverick, I was on the Top Gun staff many years ago. Later on, I had the privilege and honor of being the flight leader of the Navy Blue Angels for 2 years. And it was in those periods that I learned quite a bit about leadership and teamwork that I continue to apply today. I'm currently the COO of an aviation company on the West Coast in California.
So a COO, obviously that's you're responsible for operations, and right. That means making sure that things are delivered on time, right? And
absolutely,
the team is working together properly.
Right, exactly. Making sure that the various units in the company are all coordinated and supporting each other. And I also refer to myself as the high-speed cheerleader in the company as well.
High-speed cheerleader, that's great. So, we've talked about this on the show a little bit before. There's a difference between, military culture and civilian business culture. What are some of the differences that you've seen? Now, what are the things that are similar?
Well, I think that, frankly, there are a lot of differences, of course. The military operates under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and we are pretty much a 24/7, 365 operation. So in that sense, it's a bit different. But frankly, I would hope that the listeners are open to the fact that actually there are very many similarities. We're all operating under high stress with low margins for error. We need really good people, and we need to be able to retain them and have them operate at a very high level. There's always constant stress. There's always change. Sometimes errors and mistakes can be very, very costly. So I think there's a lot of similarities.
A lot of similarities. One of the things that we chatted about briefly before we started the show was about the idea of trust. And I'm thinking, for myself and for members of the audience of the Edges of Lean, we spend a lot of time in organizations trying to deliver a change in culture, movement towards a continuous improvement culture. And the first thing that happens when you come into an organization, whether you're an internal person or you're an external person, is that you're not necessarily looked at with a great deal of trust, right? So I would love if you would start out just defining for us, when you say trust, and we're talking about in the business environment, what does that mean to you?
Right. Well, what it means to me is that it's at its very essence, I believe it's a willingness to be vulnerable. You have to be, in order to get things done, as you're operating as a team, you have to be able to depend on other people and they to depend on you. And so you need to trust them with literally with your success. You need to trust them with your finances, you know, your growth, your productivity and all of that. And you know, I found that everything that I learned in aviation, where I depended on and I had to trust my wingmen and therefore they had to trust me, all those basic fundamental principles apply on the ground as well as in the air.
I had the opportunity a few months ago. I was in San Diego and had the opportunity to tour the Midway, which is aircraft carrier that is now a museum in San Diego. And there was one of the retired pilots there who told us about what it was like to land and take off from an aircraft carrier, which is moving, right? The aircraft carrier is moving. The planes, the plane is, the way that the runway goes is not the way the ship is necessarily moving. It's going up and down, all of these things. And it takes a lot of teamwork to do that. And George, what is the sort of the typical time between one aircraft landing and the next aircraft landing?
Yeah, in the daytime, we try to land an airplane every 45 seconds. And at nighttime, we try to land one every minute, because whenever the ship is always steaming into the wind in order to avoid any crosswind, because the deck is so small that you want to be able to put the airplane right on centerline. And so when the air wing is launching or recovering airplanes, then the ship is predictable, which is not a good thing when you're trying to avoid threats. So we try to get on and off the ship as quickly as possible. And so then the captain can maneuver the ship as necessary to avoid threats.
So that's 45 seconds. So how many people does it take to make that happen?
Well, I tell you, an aircraft carrier is an unbelievable organization. I mean, the ship itself is 1,058 feet long. It displaces 81,000 tons, and there's 75 high-performance aircraft on there with a crew of nearly 5,000 men and women who come from all walks of life, from all races, all ethnicities, all backgrounds, and they all come together under a common mission and shared sacrifice in order to operate effectively together. And it's one of the flight deck of a carrier is probably one of the most dangerous places to work. And so it's just remarkable. And people don't realize that the average age of the crew is somewhere around 23, 24 years old. I mean, it's a very young crew that come together and work amazingly well together. It's an extraordinary thing.
So there's 5,000 people doing all kinds of things that make these operations possible.
Right.
And I think that's just, it's such an interesting situation to me. So you have young people, obviously trained or being trained,
right?
Who have this huge responsibility. I mean, people's lives are in their hands, their own lives are in their hands, and right. You want to have trust in that environment. What are the kinds of things that are done to develop that trust? And because it seems to me that you might not even on any particular day, you wouldn't necessarily know who those people are. Some of them you might know, but some of them you might not even know.
Right. Of course. Well, you know, it's all a matter of training and having a set of routine and standards and procedures and protocols that we have to adhere to in order to make sure that the outcome is predictable and so forth. And while I may not know everybody on the ship per se, I know what kind of training they've been through. And on the flight deck, it's very interesting that it's such a noisy environment that everybody who has whatever role you have on the flight deck, the sailors are wearing a different colored jersey. So just visually, you can see who is responsible for what. And depending upon the color and some of the striping on the uniform, you can tell to what level they've been trained. And so, for example, taxiing the jet around the flight deck at night. The lights are off, it's dark. As you said, maybe the deck is moving and pitching, and it could be raining and all of that. And you're taxiing literally up within inches of the edge of the flight deck, following a taxi director's signals with these two wands that he's using to direct you. And it takes an amazing amount of trust. But over time, we train together, and you know who are the, who are the folks that you can absolutely trust without condition. And that's how we operate. And you may find it interesting that when I was the flight leader for the Blue Angels, for 2 years, it's a 2-year assignment. And in the 2 years I was the leader, I never forgot the lesson, the tragedy that befell our Air Force brethren, the Air Force Thunderbirds. When they were doing a formation loop in training back on January 18th, 1982, I even know the date. And on this day, when you're flying that close together, I don't know if you've seen a flight demonstration, a formation demonstration, but I mean, we were literally flying within 2 feet of each other, doing 300, 400, 500 miles an hour at very low altitude, doing three-dimensional formation aerobatics. And when the wingmen are flying that close, they're not looking around enjoying the scenery. They are totally focused on this hot piece of metal that's, another airplane that's within a couple feet, right? So on this day, tragically, the leader didn't pull out, and they put four T-38 fighters symmetrically spaced into the desert floor, killing all four pilots. So that was the extreme environment we were in. And so for me to be successful as the flight leader of the Blue Angels, I needed to figure out, what do I have to do such that my wingmen would come to work every day and literally put their life in my hands, and do that enthusiastically so that we could become as good as we possibly could. And, frankly, I wasn't smart enough to have it all figured out ahead of time, but we had 2 really successful years flying air shows at 70, over 70 cities over that 2-year period. And when I look back on that experience, I realized that there were five things that I had to pay attention to in order to earn that unconditional trust. And for each one of the five, there was a question that my team was asking about me, either consciously or unconsciously. And depending upon the answers they discerned to those questions, they would make a judgment on to what degree do they trust me. And the challenge with trust is that we often judge our trustworthiness based on the people that trust us the most, right? My friend John trusts me, I must be trustworthy. If Mary doesn't trust me, Mary must have trust issues, because I'm
It's
clearly
her fault,
trustworthy.
right? It's
That's
definitely her
right.
fault. It's not,
That's
it has
right.
nothing to do with your behavior. Right.
Yeah. And trust isn't binary. It isn't, either you have it or you don't. It's a continuum. It's analog. And you are at different places on that continuum, depending upon the various people that you're interacting with. So you may be, trusted by some people, but not by others. You may be trusted now, but not tomorrow. You may be trusted in one area, but not another. So it's very dynamic, and it takes, you have to be aware of that as you're interacting with your team.
So you came up with these five pillars or principles and the five questions. Was that something that you realized after the 2 years? Was this coming to you as you were flying with the Blue Angels? What was your pro the process like of coming to this realization?
Yeah, well, none of them are rocket science, right? And I suspect, the listeners here, they all have heard these things over the years. I know that I must have had it intuitively, that it was something, that I needed to work on. But it was after the fact, When I would be asked to come and speak to organizations about how did we train and operate and so forth, and I felt that this was the one thing that people really aren't hearing really much anywhere else that distinguished and was absolutely critical to our success. Because, you know, sometimes it's funny when I talk to groups of type A personalities, you know, just imagine these high intense salesmen in financial services or wherever, you know, when I talk about the importance of trust, I can sort of see their eyes start to roll back in their head as they start thinking about, oh man, trust, that just feels so touchy-feely, so kind of fuzzy. But my experience in the high-performance teams that I was on, trust wasn't just something nice to have. It wasn't something that is a natural byproduct of putting, you know, skilled people together. It was a strategic imperative. I mean, we absolutely had to have it. So we recruited for trustworthiness. We trained to build it every day. If you had it, you got rewarded and promoted. And if you lost it and couldn't get it back quickly, you were either sidelined or gone very, very soon, because it wasn't something that we could compromise on.
But it works two ways, right? So you've been talking about the trustworthiness of the leader. So you were talking about the questions that your team would had of you, but it works the other way too, right? In terms of your ability to trust and to create an environment where people are able to speak freely, right?
Because— Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it worked both ways. I certainly had to lead by example and try to develop, you know, the culture accordingly. But I believe these are the same five questions I was asking about them. And I believe these are the same five questions that our listeners, the people in their lives, are asking about them every day and making judgments consciously or unconsciously. And as the father of two daughters, you know, I'm not advocating that we trust blindly. I frankly hope that they're asking these five questions about the young men that ask them out and so forth, so they make a judgment on, you know, who to trust and who not to trust, because that's important too. We don't want to just trust anybody that comes along.
Wow. Okay. So you want to share one of those questions with us?
Oh yeah, sure. So again, there were five, and I had to pay attention to all five. If I dropped one out, we were going to have a setback. But the good news is that as you pay attention to one, it reinforces the other four. They're really interrelated as you have an up spiral of trust and confidence as you do this work. And it's not a chicken rotisserie. You can't set it and forget it. You have to pay attention to these all the time, because it's never, ever, you know, it's, again, it's dynamic. You have to always be, and trust can't be expected. It can't be bought. It can't be coerced. It can't be demanded. It's a gift. And you may be on a honeymoon initially when you show up as a new leader, but quickly you have to earn this every single day. Okay. So the first area, the first pillar is character. And the question my team was asking about me was simply, do you walk your talk? Do you live up to your responsibilities? Do you keep your promises? Do you live our shared values? That's what they were interested in. And they were making the judgment about my character with the only yardstick that they really had, and that was my behavior. So they were
what
just
they could see.
That's right. Which is different than sometimes we judge our own character, right? Whenever our behavior deviates from our values a bit, you know, and we have a little bit of cognitive dissonance going on, we typically evaluate our character by our intentions rather than our behaviors. But it's really the behavior that matters and how people are going to make a judgment about it. So that was the first one.
So are you going to walk? Are you actually walking the talk? And then, and does that then kind of flip into that you, as you are communicating with people, whether that's, you know, what you're saying to them, the memos you're sending them, the your availability or lack of availability to them, Does that drive then in yourself a higher consciousness of, is this the talk I want them to hear?
Yeah, very much. And the fifth one is communication, and we can get to that. But
So that circles around to the
your
answer.
personal example is really everything, right? And you oftentimes, when faced with a challenge or a crisis, or the question you have to ask yourself is, how do I want to be viewed, judged by my folks in terms of how I'm going to respond to this crisis? Am I going to be looking out for them? Am I going to be walking our talk? Or am I going to compromise our values here in the short term? And I see that happening all the time. There's plenty of examples of organizations across all dimensions of life who have betrayed a feeling of trust, and it's because they have, made a decision in the short term to abdicate their some of their values. And I don't believe some of these companies have, come along and then just gone off a cliff one day. They just compromise every day. They go, well, I'm going to move the line over here. It's not that big a deal. And then they move it again, and then they move it again. And then pretty soon they find themselves in a place that they never expected. And they're on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post for something that they're embarrassed about. So.
For something that they kind of crept their way into, right?
Yeah,
But
exactly. You're trying to get short-term gains, and okay, we're going to compromise this month, but it won't matter, and we'll stick to the game later. Well, pretty soon, everything has changed.
and that, that makes me think about some of the situations that certainly I've seen in my career where there's a very clear set of values that are developed and communicated, and the expectation is that everybody acts on them, but the policies of the organization or the processes of the organization actually don't support those values, right? So they haven't been updated, or haven't been looked at critically to say, well, if what we value is this, then we need to take a look at this. And I'm thinking of, for example, some HR policies around, say, we have a value of open communication, but then you have an HR policy about who can talk to who about whom about what, some of which may be necessary for business purposes, but there's never any clear clarification of, well, if we do this, it's because of this, and here's how we. Here's why we understand that it is not the value that we're talking about doesn't align with this policy. Does that make sense?
Oh
I
yeah,
feel like we
absolutely.
move so fast, sometimes we don't even notice these things.
Yeah, we don't pay attention to what the unintended consequences can be. And you can have, I've seen organizations that have wonderful people in them that are trying to do their very best and appear to be, one-on-one, they're great people, but organizationally, the organization isn't trusted, because they have policies and procedures in the way of doing business that the messages that they send, I don't want to offend anybody today, but my personal pet peeve is AT&T. I mean, everybody I've met from AT&T in person are wonderful, but the organization itself, sort of treats you like just a number, and you're on hold for an hour to get a hold of somebody, and they keep repeating this recording that says how much they value you as a customer, and please wait. We appreciate your patience. The messages we send, we have to be careful, organizationally, how we're behaving. And I talk to people, you've got to ask these five questions about your company too, because they may be the customers, the partners, the suppliers, everybody might have a different view than you think.
Right. So your first question is about character. Are you good? Are
Right.
you do you do you walk the talk?
That's
So
right. Do you
what?
walk the talk? Yeah. The second one is commitment. And my team was very, they were very sure from the day I arrived as a leader that I was going to show up with a smile on my face to lead them whenever the sun was shining and the sky was blue and the air was smooth. But But they knew that, you know, during our time together, there were going to be storms. And because that's the way life is, you're either in a storm now, or you've just come out of a storm, or you're getting ready to go into the next storm, right? And so what they wanted to know was, are you going to be with us when the going gets tough, when we have to take a punch? And not only are you going to be with us, but are you going to show up playing your A game and leading us through the storm to the other side? Because if you're just going to show up and take names, cast blame, point fingers, CYA, forget about it. We want you to, you know, be the best leader you can be and help us get through this challenge. And, you know, when it comes down to at some point a moment of truth where you have to pick which are you going to put first, the team or yourself? You know, you better put the team first. So that was the second one.
Because they're
And,
going
you
to be
know,
looking for that. Yeah.
and the question, you know, I ask people is where does commitment come from? You know, how, where does that come from? And after thinking about it, you know, I believe it comes from a very deep, a very clear, and a very intense sense of purpose. We in the military call it mission. When you know what mission you're on, and why it is very important to you individually and to the organization. You don't have to motivate people. You just have to train them, resource them, give them the benefit of your experience, and then get out of the way because people are on fire when you can help them get very clear about their purpose rather than just going through day to day to day, you know, like Groundhog Day. When they know that they're striving for something really important and it's important to them, then they get fired up and the commitment goes very, very high.
But aren't there two pieces of that? I mean, part of that is how the leader is able to create that commitment, help to show what, you know, why the purpose is important, right? That's again, that goes back to the communication. And yeah, but there's another piece of it, which is that not every purpose is going to align with every single person, right?
No,
So
no.
it's also, yeah, it's like a self-check. It's like if I'm in this involved in this organization, and their purpose isn't aligning with what I know my own purpose is, well, maybe that's a wake-up call to me as well.
Yeah, and you know, you know, we as leaders are very, very good about talking about the what and the how. Here's what we're going to do, and here's how we're going to do it. But I find that leaders, for some reason, are reluctant to talk about the why. And the team is hungry for the why. They want to know, why is this work important? Why is it important to you? You know, why should we, you know, get fired up about what we're doing together and sacrificing together and so forth? And as leaders, if we can, and this will come to another one of these in a minute in connection. But when we can help our people, you know, think about what's important to them. And for the young people, it may only be something in the next 2 or 3 years or 5 years at most, maybe. But when you can help them think about where do you want to go in this gift we have of one life and how working with you is going to help them develop in some way that will help them get there, then they line up and come along, you know. And frankly, if the purpose diverges enough, then they may not be a good fit for you, you know. And so I think that's part of, as we're hiring people, you want to make sure that you find people who are trustworthy in general and have a sense of purpose that is aligned with what the organization's trying to accomplish.
And it's not a bad thing to identify that, you know, a person's purpose and the purpose of the organization not aligned. It's better to find that early on than to
That's
find
right.
it later.
Yeah, it's going to be there, and it's going to cause, you know, at some point some sort of hesitation, separation. That's why a lot of people are disengaged. They just don't see, they're not getting any juice from the work that they're doing every day, and they keep being asked to do more and more, and they're just not inspired by it. So therefore, they just do enough not to get fired.
So what comes next?
So the next one is competence, and this is critically important. I believe this is where we make most of our judgments about people's trustworthiness when we're making hiring decisions or promotions or assignments and so forth. So somebody's skill level is very important. But I think about it third for a reason, because I believe if you don't get the first two, this one doesn't really matter. I mean, if somebody doesn't walk our shared talk and our values and isn't committed, isn't all in, then, you know, how good they are, they're just going to be a problem and so forth. But if you can get the first two, if they are, you know, aligned with you in terms of values and hard work and whatever else your organization standards you set, and they are all in, as long as they are reasonably skilled and competent, you can teach them pretty much what they know. And for the Blue Angels, you know, we would trade off if we had two pilots that were a very similar skill level, but one had the first two and the other one not so much. We would be willing to trade off a percentage or two of skill in order to make sure we got the first two. So every day as I walked in for the pre-flight briefing and sat down at the conference table, and you know, I looked around at my wingmen, I could see the third question in their eyes. And the question was, are you good enough to be our leader today? Are you better than you were yesterday, but not as good as you're going to be tomorrow? Because we don't want to stay here. You know, leadership is all about change. It's all about taking the organization from one place to someplace new. And they wanted to keep getting better and better every day. And they knew that we as a team couldn't get better if I, as a leader, didn't keep getting better. Because I realized very quickly that, as all leaders should recognize, is that I could have a good day and my team might still have an average day, but my team would never have a great day if I, as a leader, didn't have a great day, because I was, by definition, the one that was going to bring them over center point as smoothly and effectively as possible so they could show the world what extraordinary pilots they were.
That's so interesting that, you know, that people want to see that the leader is improving, that the leader's commitment is committed to improvement. And it's so important for us who are doing improvement work, you know. So if you're, you know, working in an organization, and I've seen this happen, the leader wants the organization to improve, but they're not willing to make any change themselves, then
Absolutely.
that change is never going to happen. Right? Because people are
That's
going to look
correct.
and say, well, they're not learning anything new. They're not improving. So, you know, what's the point of me doing it?
Yeah, they're not walking the talk, right?
Yeah.
They want everybody else to change, but they want to still do it their own way. And the other thing that I've seen also is that, you know, leaders want to be able to do whatever they want and just say, you know, as the wingman, if you will, you just have to follow me. It's your job to follow me. I'm a leader. I can be erratic. I can do whatever I want. Well, a really good leader does whatever is necessary to help the wingman excel and succeed. That's what it's really all about. You are setting them up for success so that you, as a team and an organization, can succeed. And, you know, the two things that I share with people, and there's a lot that goes into becoming really good in whatever area you're in. But for us, flying these F-18 fighters as a team, the two keys for our success as a team that I share with people, one is, you know, we grow up and we hear the notion from our parents and our coaches and our teachers and so forth that practice makes perfect. But we didn't believe that with the Blue Angels. What we believed was that, you know, practice makes consistency. So if you're practicing poorly, haphazardly, indifferently, infrequently, that's the result you're going to get. So what we believed was perfect practice makes perfect. So we never just went out and just climbed in the jets and started the engines and taxied out and went flying. We always lined up, marched down, climbed in the jets. We followed our protocols and procedures. We taxied out in formation. We took off. And even if we were just flying from point A to point B, we would fly in formation because that's what we were. We were a demonstration squadron, right? So our motto was, we want to practice till we get it right and then keep practicing until we can't get it wrong. And that was really the key to our success in being able to fly 6 days a week for 11 and a half months of the year for 2 years and do it in such very close formation and do it safely. The other thing that we did that was absolutely key to our continuous improvement, and I dare say that very few organizations do this, and I share this all the time, but that was after every flight, no matter what, we would have a debrief and we would talk about what happened. Because not everybody's got their own perspective on what just happened in this event. And so we would, everybody would share in coming up with, okay, what happened out there? Why did it happen? The good and the bad. We want to reinforce the good and we want to try to prevent the bad from happening again. And then what can we learn that we can apply then to our next flight? And so that we can continuously improve. And your listeners may find it curious, but here's how we did a debrief. I, as the leader, would start the debrief and I would set the tone, make a few comments about how the flight went. And then I would confess, if you will, if there were any significant mistakes that I made during the flight. Because what that did was that set the tone that, hey, mistakes happen. And as long as you're willing to own up to it and accept responsibility and do everything you can to avoid a reoccurrence, that's okay. That's part of being human and trying to continue to improve. It also gave my wingman a good assessment of to what degree was I able to have self-awareness of my own performance. Because if I'm making mistakes and I don't know it, we got a problem. If I'm making mistakes and I won't admit them, we got another problem. Because, and the wingmen, they know, they're watching the leader all the time and they know. And so it's really important for you. And this is where the vulnerability comes in. You have to be willing to share that, hey, I screwed that up. And then that sets the example. And then we would go around the room and literally everybody that was involved in the demonstration would share confess any mistakes that they made. So we all got it out on the table. And you really have it right when people will share something, a mistake they made that nobody else would have otherwise known, but they want to get it out there so other people can learn from it and make sure that their teammates don't make the same mistake as well. That's really cool. And then we would get into the very specifics of the debrief, and we would run a videotape and we would analyze it and we scored all the maneuvers and all of that. We got into the analytics and no detail was too small not to address and just to see how we could do it better. And then at the end, we would go around and everybody would have, one final comment or so before we adjourned. And we all ended our comments with the very same three or four words. We would, in order to remind ourselves of what a privilege it was to be part of such a wonderful organization that was committed to excellence, no matter what kind of a day you had, we would all end our comments with, I'm glad to be here. For example,
That's great. Yeah.
I might say, well, tomorrow I'm looking forward to getting out. I screwed up this maneuver today, but I'm looking forward to fixing it tomorrow and I'm glad to be here. And then number two, pilot would say that, and number three and number four around. And it was, when I first got there, I thought it sounded a little bit corny, but it's very powerful. When you, just by saying those words, changes your demeanor, if you will. And when you hear everybody else that you're sacrificing with say that they're glad to be part of the organization. It just is very reinforcing. It's wonderful.
Wow. So, I mean, so when you talk about the after action review, you know, it's very similar to what we in Lean, you know, do with a daily huddle, you know, where we'll talk about what went well, what, you know, what didn't go well, you know, how we can, you know, solve the problems so that they don't reoccur. But that piece at the end, that's really marvelous. That's because what you're doing is you're creating gratitude, right? You're
Exactly.
finding your reason for gratitude for
Exactly.
being there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Because as we know, you know, the negative is so much powerful psychologically to us as humans than the positive, right? And so it's easy just to beat yourself up, and then the mood is a bit negative. So it's a way for us to recapture and get resynced of who we are and what we're about.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you. All right, so where are we in your
Okay, we're number 4. Okay,
number
so
four.
Number 4, and this is the one I think most leaders in 2024 are missing. And number 4 is connection. You see, by the middle of the air show season my first year, our team got so connected that I could literally change the trajectory of a maneuver based on the inflection of my voice on the radios. Not the words I said, the way I said the words. They would know if I needed to speed the roll of the formation to stay underneath some clouds, I could do that. If I needed to pull harder at the bottom of a loop in order to avoid a ridgeline or a bridge, I could do that. If I needed to tighten the turn and pull more G's to go around a building, I could do that. And my wingmen would follow me right there in close formation because they knew that I understood what I was asking them to do, that I understood the challenges that they were going to face by my decision, and that I was taking them into account when I made my decision to do something different than what we had normally done, right? But if for a minute they doubted that I understood what I was asking them to do, now you suddenly have hesitation and separation and disengagement, right? So the question that I had to ask myself every day was, do they believe I understand them? Which is a different question than do I believe I understand them? Because what I believe is interesting, but not sufficient. What matters is what do they believe? And when they believe that you get them, that you understand the challenges that they're facing out there on the front line and their hopes and what their concerns are and their ideas, then they'll join up and come along. But if they don't believe that you understand what's going on out there, then they're just going to disengage, right? So that's number 4.
And in the environment that you were in, you were working together very closely every day, traveling together, presumably, you know, eating together, spending a lot of time together. And what you're saying is, so when we don't work like that anymore, right? We're remote. I think there's a different, you know, a different sense of, you know, what we share, what we don't share, separation of our life and our work life.
No question. But these, I believe these principles are universal. And so, and when we're not able to be together as much, where we have these, you know, unconscious, informal reassurances and communication and so forth, then with our teammates who are working remotely, we have to, as leaders, overdo on some of these things in order to make sure that we make the connection. We have to take time to just visit, right? To get to know people beyond the work a little bit so that we really understand what's happening with them. And so, you know, so that we can take them into account whenever we're making decisions and so forth. So yeah, it's tough. There's no question. It's easier whenever you're together all the time in order to build and maintain connections, because you get the signals pretty quickly whenever somebody's having an issue or something that needs to get resolved. Sure.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, yeah, you don't have those lunchtime conversations or the coffee room conversations, you know, those things. Yeah, we missed something with that.
Absolutely.
Definitely harder work but I don't think it's impossible, but it means making, as you said, time and space for it, right? You've got to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, when somebody's new, they need to have an in-person connection with who they're going to be working with. So I think you need to bring them in and they need to, you know, spend a week or whatever time is necessary in order to connect. And then you just have to reignite that in order to reinforce it, to make sure that you don't lose it over time.
Number five.
So if connection is, do they believe I understand them? Then communication is the fifth one. And that question is, do they understand me? And am I being clear, concise, and direct and consistent in my communications and my transmissions in order for it to get through all the clutter and distractions that are out there? Now, in aviation, we have, you know, very specific protocols in order to avoid a misunderstanding, which could be, you know, catastrophic, right? So whenever an air traffic controller and I'm flying gives me a direction, then I repeat back that direction verbatim to make sure that there was not a misunderstanding. And I think that that's often missing in our communications in organizations, is that we don't take time to find out, was the message I sent the one that they actually received, right? Because too often it's misunderstood. And you know, the challenge for leaders in communication is the assumption that it's occurred. I sent the email, they get it. I gave the speech, they get it. I had the one-on-one, the difficult conversation, you know, he gets it. They don't get it, at least not yet anyway. You know, you think about how many times do you have to hear a new song before you understand the lyrics? Right.
Yeah.
We have to transmit
sometimes years, right?
A long time, right? And we get tired of transmitting often before the audience has received the message. So we have to be very consistent and continue to transmit in a variety of ways in order to make sure that the audience has received the message. And oftentimes that requires just asking, okay, what did you just hear? Or, you know, what do you think about that? And make sure that they can read back to you pretty much the message that you sent, right?
Right. And the message may be, in a way, you know, it's maybe more complex, you know, than climb to 10,000 feet, right? In a way, that's easy, right? Climb to 10,000 feet, you know, climb to 10,000 feet, you know, and
that's right.
Spark properly.
And we're closer to the message because we've been thinking about it for a while and we've been noodling on it, you know, and now we've come out and now we transmit. And the people, the audience, this is the first time they're hearing it. And it may be something new and different. And to your point, you know, it may be nuanced, right? And so they're not going to get it, at least not the way you get it, until you transmit multiple ways and give them the opportunity to absorb and digest it.
I think that this is a fascinating conversation, and I know that people are going to want to learn more from you, George. What's the best way for them to find you?
Well, they can get me on the internet there. I have a website, georgedom.com.
That's easy.
And in there, they can see I've got, you know, blog posts and so forth. You know, I can send you a QR code that you might put in the notes, if you will. I can offer a 12 weeks, and this is free. I'm not selling anything, but when I give presentations, I want it to be more than just one and done. And so what I offer to the audience is, if they want to learn more about this and get some tips on how to apply it every day, I have 12 emails that I would send weekly, one each week, that goes over what we've talked about today and provides some additional information and some ideas on, hey, what do I have to do in order to A, build my character muscle, as well as how do I communicate to somebody who's important to me professionally as well as personally, that I walk my talk and help begin that upward spiral. Because the thing about it is that no matter how good a team you're on right now, no matter how good the relationship is with somebody in your life, if you do this and proactively work on deepening the level of trust, you can make the relationship even better. Nobody ever says, that Bella, I don't like her. She's too trustworthy. Can't happen, right? So, it's
That's great.
a great work to do, and it really makes all the difference. And, for us, I get it. We absolutely had to be uncompromising about this, because for us, if we didn't do this work, at best it was mission failure, and at worst it could be deadly. It could be a fireball, right? But the people listening here, their work typically, is not quite that extreme. But I ask them to consider, if you could raise the level of trust in the relationships that are important to you by even 15 or 20%, would that make a difference? And I believe it'd be profound, quite frankly. So.
I think that's absolutely true. And the other thing that I think is important for us to consider, particularly for those of us who are involved in change, is that it might not be, something as visibly tragic as, an aircraft accident, right? But you could be causing pain in other people's lives that you're not seeing. And I don't think anybody wants to do that. I don't think we want to be creating pain for other people. But we may be doing that inadvertently by our work and by our relationships. So it sounds to me that what you're talking about could certainly be a safety, it's a safety protocol for people.
Oh,
Maybe,
sure.
and taking care of people in a different way.
Yeah,
George, what would be
absolutely.
your one piece of advice for a young person starting out?
So for young folks that are starting out, for me, I was never the best pilot in my class in flight school. I realized early on. I mean, I had generally good athletic abilities and eye-hand coordination and so forth. But there were some guys who were just, it was unbelievable. And so I reconciled myself that, okay, I may not be the ace of the base, but I am going to do everything I can. I'm going to work harder than anybody, so that when my name shows up on a flight schedule as an assignment to fly with somebody, they're going to go, this is going to be a good flight, because Dom always shows up ready to go, and so forth. So that would be my advice to young people, is to, do the hard work that's necessary to earn the trust of the people that you're going to be working with, whether in school or out in your career.
Great advice. Thank you. Hey, Captain George Don, thank you so much for traveling with me to the edges of Lean in a jet aircraft. Thanks.
You're very welcome. My pleasure, Bella. Thank you.
This is Bella Engelberg, and I'd like to thank Captain George Don for being my guest at the edges of Lean. What did you learn from this conversation? What ideas did it spark? We would love to hear from you. You can find George at georgedob.com. He's also on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn or at leanforhumans.com, or comment wherever you watch or listen. And check out all my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com, where you will find lots of great new content every week. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelberg with support from Podcast Inc. Hey, don't forget to subscribe. This is a Lean for Humans production.